little bit of a voice problem. Fact is, I would appreciate your praying for that. About last May, I came down with a cold and I went to the doctor, and after a period of time, got over the cough, but never did get my voice back real well. So after a period of time seeing a specialist, they say my right vocal cord is paralyzed. And so don't know why, still doing some testing and that type of thing. One alternative is go through the neck, operate, take a plastic plug, push the dead one over close to the live one. And I told the doctor I didn't think we wanted to do that right now. So we will pray and see what God does. And whatever God does is all right. Okay? Now I want to talk to you tonight about expectations. Now in order to do that, we're going to have to give you a little history lesson. Okay? If you're like I was in history, you didn't enjoy history very much, but I hope this will be a little bit more interesting than most of the history courses you've ever set in. I did a little bit of this last night over to Tri-Delta House. I was asked to speak, but want to do some things that will be somewhat different than I did last night. You have certain expectations for life. You have certain expectations as a Christian. Tonight, I don't want to be discouraging to you, but I do want to pop some of your bubbles. I want us to talk about where your expectations came from, what are realistic expectations, what can you expect God to do, what will He do, and what are the expectations you have that have nothing to do with God, and yet you may think they do. So let's talk a little bit about history of America. Before 1929 in America, things had been pretty hard. Everyone worked hard. You just grew up expecting things to be hard, expecting them to be difficult. So people worked hard. And then came along two world wars, and people sacrificed during that time. They worked hard. I'm 56 years of age, but I can even remember back what it was like during the Second World War. I can remember wanting a little toy gun for Christmas, a little metal gun, and there weren't any. Because at that time, all the metals were going into war goods. I can remember us walking quite a bit because you didn't just go buy new tires anytime you wanted to. Tires were rationed. Sugar was rationed. There were many things in America that were rationed because the people that did not go to war sacrificed to keep the men there to try to win the world war. And as a result, largely of America, the Second World War was won. As a result of that, there was a tremendous sense of victory when the soldier boys came home. And in America, we had never experienced anything quite like that. The tremendous sense of optimism that was in America. Now, when the soldier boys came home, immediately we had what we called a baby boom. And when those soldier boys came home, they'd missed their wives and everybody was getting married. I mean, it was the thing to get married. Every girl wanted to get married. Every girl wanted to have children. So there started a great baby boom. Not everyone was having large families because the large family wasn't necessarily the thing. Now, a lot of them had large families because, as one of the writers said, I think it was Landon Jones, people in America didn't know how not to have babies. So everyone was having children. I mean, children everywhere. You couldn't believe what was happening in America because there was such a sense of expectancy. If the wife gets pregnant, so what? I mean, I've got a good job. From 1950 to 1970, every 10 years, or during that time, income was doubling. And so there'd never been a greater time in America. Parents begin to feel like our children won't have it so hard. In fact, as we were told that, I was born 10 years too early to be in those that are called the baby boomers because that's the ones that were born from 1946 to 1964. Most of your parents, if they're those people would be 46 years of age. If your parents are somewhere in that neighborhood, they are baby boomers. And that has a deep effect on you. We're going to talk about that some later. But as a result of it, in America, we started having children. I mean, and also, since it's such a sense, we had all these humongous factories in America that had been making war goods. What were we going to do with those factories? So we began to make consumer goods. We made so many consumer goods that with only, at that time, after World War II, 66% of the population of the entire world, we were making 66% of the world's consumer goods and consuming most of it ourselves. And so we decided, businessmen began to figure out, can we make consumers out of these children, out of these kids? There's so many of them. Well, they did. They became great consumers. Fact is, in America at one time, just to let you know how many babies, one out of every 10 people in America was eating baby food. You couldn't believe what was happening just as far as the number of children. Well, when they hit school age, now let me tell you this, the very first hero of the baby boomers was Hopalong Cassidy. 1950, Hopalong Cassidy was a big hero. And in 1 year, we sold $40 million worth of little Hopalong Cassidy uniforms and toy pistols. Well, then came Roy Rogers and Gene Autry, and within 1 year, we're selling $283 million worth of little Roy Rogers and Gene Autry guns. The next great hero was, after Hopalong Cassidy, there were others that came along, but Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and all those guys. The next big hero, though, was really Fess Parker, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier. Now, I've shared some of this with some of you I know, but we're going to get some things that will be somewhat different. Now, when Davy Crockett came along, they started making these little Davy Crockett coonskin caps. Coonskin went from 28 cents a pound to $8 a pound almost overnight. Every kid had to have a coonskin cap. Steven Spielberg of Star Wars fame and others said that when he was in the third grade, one day he went to class, he went to school, he did not have a Davy Crockett hat. He said, I was literally the only one in the whole third grade in my class that did not have a Davy Crockett hat. So he said, I had to play Santa Ana. Kids chased me all the way home. And he said the next day, I would not go to school until my dad had gone and bought me a coon skin cap. Davy Crockett was a big craze. Now, we'd never seen anything like this in America. We had never seen children set the tone for consumption. But within 1 year, we were selling $100 million worth of little Davy Crockett stuff. Little rifles, T-shirts. T-shirts were going for $1.29 each, and by Christmas of that year, they were selling for 33 cents, and then you couldn't give them away. Just like the boom came, as far as consumption, Davy Crockett, then it was over. It was Hopalong Cassidy, and when they got sick of Hopalong, then they wanted Davy Crockett or someone else. And so that's the way it was. All of a sudden, businesses were just, they'd just shoot up, make a mint, and then by Christmas, it would be over with. Two guys out in Pasadena, California, came up, figured out one day you could take a little piece of plastic and they could make what was known as the hula hoops. And those hula hoops they could make for about 50 cents a piece. They were selling them for $1.98, and they were making 20,000 of those a day. It wasn't long till we had 20 million hula hoops in America. And then by Christmas, you couldn't give them away. All of a sudden, the baby boomers wanted something else. They had been brought up from the very day they were born. The best of everything. You're going to have the best of food. That's when all of the best diapers, the best Pampers, the best all of this came along, the best medical care, and they were told from the day they were born, you're special, you're not going to have it as hard as we have it, you're going to have the best of everything. And so, for example, in 1956, the baby boomers long in here started hitting the school age. Los Angeles put on 1,000 new school teachers every year. For the next 10 years, they hired 1,000 more school teachers than they'd hired the year before and could not keep up. In 1 year in America, when those baby boomers started going to school, we built 62,000 new classrooms for them in 1 year and had another 78,000 classes meeting in schools, in storefronts, because, all of a sudden, no one had figured out what was really going on, but we had kids everywhere. Now, always before, since the history of the world, as far as we know, the greatest single influence in a child's life had always been his parents, his brothers and sisters, those in his immediate home. But when those children started going to school, there were so many of them, we had to deal with them in little herds. And that's when little Boy Scouts started, and Little League, and all of these things started. Because, I mean, all of a sudden, these kids now begin to experience something. Always before, they'd been very special. They'd had the best of everything. The parents had sacrificed for them and told them, you're going to have the best of everything. And then all of a sudden, they begin to hit the school years. And now, one of the greatest advantages, which had been their sheer numbers, now becomes a real disadvantage. Do you know that from 1963 until 1973, the college population in America doubled in one 10-year period? We went from 4.7 million college students to 7.4 million college students. I came to the University of Oklahoma in 1967. The campus was growing at the rate of 1,000 students a year. I mean, the campuses all over the country. The baby boomers were standing in line for everything. They have stood in line all their life. They stood in line to get in school. They stood in line to register. They stood in line to get in the military. And they're going to stand in line to get into the nursing home someday. I mean, there are just so many of them. Like someone said, it's like a python that swallowed a pig. I mean, here's the snake goes along, then all of a sudden there's a big lump. And that's what's happened. And as that pig moves along through society, I mean, it stretches, it bends everything, and that's what's happened in our American culture. Because there's been so many of these people. They started going to school. And then later, when they began to get to college, it's amazing that so many of them went to college. I mean, there was a time when a very small percentage, a generation before, maybe 26% or something like that of those people would go to college. But when that generation hit, almost 75% of them, 75% or so or more of them, it was like at one time, 26% would graduate from high school. Now over 75% of the children are graduating from high school. And then in America, like in England today, I don't know how it is, I know the way it was a number of years ago when I was there, but 1 out of 10 students would go to college. Over here, it's about 50% of the students go to college. Well, all of a sudden, we had this massive number of students. The good thing about it, they were at least kept out of the workforce for about 4 years. But you would think that we'd begin to figure out what we were going to do with all those people when they hit the workforce. Just to give you an idea how unprepared we were in America and how few people really realized how this generation was going to impact our culture. General Electric Company, in about 1952, had a 75th anniversary. They had 226,000 employees, 226,000 people that worked for General Electric. They decided that on their 75th anniversary, they would give 5 shares of stock to every baby that was born to an employee of that company. And so they talked with demographers, the people that study population, say, okay, how many shares of stock are we going to have to set aside to give away on that day? Well, the best they could come up with was 13. They thought there'd be 13 babies born on that day. You know how many babies were born to the employees of that company on that day? 189. I mean, people just could not realize what was happening. Now, they get out of the job market. Like for 1 year, when the baby boomers hit the job market, now there was a time in America, we were hiring 5 new professors for everyone that retired. 1 year, we turned out 1,225 PhDs in history. Now, when those people hit the job market, 1,225 PhDs across America in history, and in 1 year, 1,225 of them with PhDs go out and try to get a job. Only 128 out of the 1,225 can get a job. And all of a sudden, we'd told these kids all their life, you're special, major in what you want to. If you want to major in underwater basket weaving or whatever it is, you just do it, honey. You're special. You're very, very special. Now, it's okay to grow up in life feeling like you're special if you also understand very clearly it's okay for you to be special if it does not mean that other people are put down as a result of your speciality. What happened as a result of that? These kids grew up. Their parents told them they were special. Everybody told them they were special. The doctors told them they were special. They had special care. They had special toys. They had special everything. So as a result of it, they go out into the world and all of a sudden there's a reality there that they had not planned on. I mean, they hit the job markets. The jobs were not there for them because there were too many of them. Many of those people could not get the jobs that they really wanted. Certainly, there were some of them that succeeded. By far less than 10% that become the yuppies, that became those, you know, urban upward moving professionals. And they got out there, and some of those people did very well, but they paid many of those a tremendous price. Like one lady said, you know, I always wanted to have a home. But she said, when I headed out in my career, it took a lot of time. I had to concentrate very, very much just on that career. And she says, now I have my career established. But here she's wound up and now she's 28. She says, most of the eligible guys are gone. Are they gays? Are they moved on or something? I don't know where they are. But she said, right now, I'm not sure the tremendous price I paid for my career is worth it. A lot of these people that really went after their careers, and some of them got it, and now they look back, and is it worth it? Many of these people lost their families. I mean, all of a sudden, for this generation, over against the generation before, divorce was 5 times higher than it was with their parents. Out of that baby boom generation, 54% of them were divorced by the time they were 34 years of age. 54% by the time they're 34 years of age. They had not learned how to really build relationships. They grew up, the babysitter was a television. You know, in 1951, in New York alone, 55 theaters were closed in 1 year because all of a sudden television came on the scene, and the television became the babysitter for many of your moms and dads. And so the television, a child by the time he is 18 years old, for 16 years he had averaged watching television 4 hours a day for 16 solid years. He had seen over 300,000 commercials. Is it any wonder that he wants everything he ever saw all of his life? That's what had happened to that generation. You are known as the baby busters. Those are those that were born from 1965 up until, the next 18 years, which catches most of you, doesn't it? Now, we don't have a name for those that have been born in the last 10 years. Somebody has yet to name them. We don't know what they'll be called. When you're known as baby busters, that's really a misnomer. It sounds like there's been a bust. Well, all of a sudden, births dropped below 10 million a year, and that's all there was. But you are the next largest group that's ever hit in the history of the United States. So you are also a large group, but you have characteristics that are very much like those others because you've been shaped by them. When you grow up in a society, there are several things that really have influenced you. One is just the pure, for lack of a better term, just wealth that's been in America. We have never seen the kind of wealth that we saw during the time the baby boomers were raised. Their parents had worked hard. They told their children, we don't want you to have it as hard as we have it. They would work. And see, at one time, education in America, that was the way you got off the farm. I know when I was growing up, my dad went through the 8th grade. My mom had to move away to live away from home to be able to finish high school. And I heard that all my life growing up. We don't want you to have it as hard as we had it. And so parents would sacrifice. College was a way to get off the farm. Education was important. You know, I've noticed in the last few years how different knowledge was to the builder generation, and that's the generation of those that were born before the baby busters. Knowledge was extremely important. I mean, we were the notebook generation. If there's a conference 300 miles away and I could learn something, somebody was speaking, I would drive, I would take notes. Today, most of you, you're not note takers. Why? You grew up with knowledge. I mean, you grew up in this is known as knowledge explosion age. I mean, there's knowledge everywhere. You grew up with it. Knowledge is not important to you. Most of you, to be honest, you did not come to the University of Oklahoma to learn. You came because it was a necessary evil for you to be able to do what you wanted to do in the future. Knowledge is not all that important. It's a difference because of the way we were raised. Okay, your expectations. You were raised with tremendous expectations. The sad thing is that some way for us as Christians, that got all mixed up with Christianity. We wanted the same thing the non-Christian wanted. We wanted material wealth. We wanted the American dream. It's interesting because before the baby boomers came along, people lived in the inner cities. But when the baby boomers came along and the cities began to deteriorate, parents said, we don't want our children raised in the inner city, and therefore we're going to move to the suburbs. Well, do you know that in one 10-year period, the suburbs in America doubled? You think of how old America is and think that it doubled in one 10-year period? Why? Because parents said, we don't want to be in the inner city. So they went out to the suburbs. That's when we started with the two-car family, because dad's at work, mom has to haul the kids to piano lessons, to violin lessons, to this kind of lessons, swimming lessons, and all that sort of thing. And so now we've got to have two cars. All of a sudden, interestingly enough, the theater never came back in America. As I mentioned, New York had closed 55 in 1 year. Those never came back until the baby boomers got old enough to start going back to the movies. And when they did, then the theaters came back in America. And so they've deeply affected our society. Now, the affluence has affected us. It's deeply affected you. Most of us growing up in America have no idea how most of the rest of the world lives. We think that our standard of living is what we have a right to, and things that at one time were a privilege. At one time, it was a tremendous privilege to go to college. Most people today expect it. I was born in America. I have a right to go to college. And so we've grown up, and I'm glad you have the privilege to go to college. I wish everyone could go to college. But I'm just saying there's a whole different attitude and spirit towards what at one time was a privilege now becomes a right. I have a right to it. For example, health care. At one time that was a privilege in America. Today, it is a right. I mean, we don't know yet how we're going to pay for it. We won't worry about that. We're going to have it. For the first time in history, the baby boomers said, we now have a baby boom president, and we may all be in trouble because there's a tremendous sense of expectancy. We have an unbelievable sense of expectancy. We have a right to own a house. We have a right someday to two cars. We have a right to this. We have a right for vacations. You know, I know of a situation where a man was riding on a train in England. He was talking to this guy, and he said, you know one thing I don't like about you Americans? He said, what's that? He says, you think you have to have it all. You know, we do believe the Michelob ad, you can have it all. And he says, you know, in England, I have a pretty good job for this culture. But he says, our family cannot go on vacation and own a car. Now, if we're going to own a car, we don't get to go on a vacation, but we have to make a choice. But in America, you not only have a car, you're going to have two or three cars. You're also going to go on vacation. He said, now another thing in England, if we have a car, then we can't go on vacation. Or we can decide to go out and eat some, but we can't own a car or go on vacation because there's just not enough money for us to be able to do that. Now I want to ask you something. If you were in that situation, what would your attitude be? See, we've gotten American affluence, and the fact that we've been raised is so mixed up with Christianity. Even, you see this in answer to prayer, for example. You know, and you've seen a lot of this on television, that we have a right to be rich. We have a right to all this. I wonder what will happen. And let me tell you what started happening to this baby boom generation. The biggest blow they had ever received, the first time that ever been anything bad happened to them. I mean, all that bumped their head in the nursery and stuff like that. But I'm talking about as far as nationally. The first bad thing that happened in November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas, Texas. You know what it was? Do you know that you can ask nearly any baby boomer what happened on that date and they can tell you exactly where they are? Because they remember that, because that was a real trauma for that generation when John Kennedy was shot. I mean, here was a young president, healthy, you know, great, rich, all of that, and then one day he's killed. And then after that, it was Martin Luther King. It was Robert Kennedy. And then other tragic things. Then it was Watergate, and things began to happen. We're still holding on to our expectations. We're going to have the good life. We're going to have the best of everything. Nothing bad's ever supposed to happen to us because we're special. The society is hanging on to that. But over a period of time, some things do begin to happen. When they begin to get out, they can't all get the jobs they want. I mean, I don't know if you read the papers or you ever see the news, but do you see what's happening in our own culture? Some of you, and I'm not saying this to discourage you, but if you don't get some realistic expectations and realize what's biblical and what isn't, now maybe God will tremendously continue to bless us and we will have far more than we deserve. And some of you sitting here will make a lot of money in your lifetime, and I really hope you do. And I hope you'll use it for the honor and glory of God. You know that right now there are places in Eastern Europe where you can totally, I mean completely, support a missionary on $100 a month. I know Sandra and I, with one other fellow, are supporting a lady who's giving her full time to child evangelism in Eastern Europe. There are other countries where for $200 a month you can completely support a full-time missionary in those countries. Now, you couldn't support an American over there. But you know that in India today, you can support 100 full-time Indian missionaries for what you can do with one American family to go over there and live, because those people know. I had a friend who went to Africa this summer on a mission trip. They were just trying to raise money so they could give these people a $35 bicycle. And some of those African pastors were thrilled to death just to have a bicycle. And maybe he pastors several churches and they're miles apart. And he is thrilled to death with a bicycle. He was born in Africa. You've been born in America. What if times got hard? Would you still have joy in the Lord? Could you be like Paul? He said, I know how to be abased. I know how to have plenty. And I know how to be in need. But regardless of which way it is, I also know how to rejoice in the Lord. Nobody knows what's going to happen in America. But if you don't watch out, you get your expectations even on God. You take these expectations that come as a result of your living in America and you place those on God. And see, we've seen a lot of that in the theology that's rampant and hit this country. The name it and claim it, you know. God wants you to be rich. And I've heard this with my own ears on television. And some of the worst stale theology that's ever hit America comes out of Tulsa. Do you know that? I mean, I want to promise you it's true. And it's not from one source, it's from several of them. And that is, how much do you want God to bless you? I mean, He promised to bless you 100-fold. So if you'll send in a dollar to our ministry, then God will give you back $100. Isn't that what God promised? Or, why don't you send in $100 and God will give you $10,000? Isn't that what God promised? Let's put down a little seed faith. Now folks, watch out for that, because you get all that mixed up. And even when it comes to prayer. You know, I've read something just the last few days that's encouraged me about prayer. I know many times in life I've prayed about things and I don't know how it's going to come out. You know, like I prayed about my vocal cord. I don't know if God is going to restore it, or it's going to stay like it is the rest of my life, or it's going to be the point where it'll be difficult talking someday. I don't know what God's going to do. I know I can pray, but I know one thing. According to the Scriptures, I don't have any right to command that He do that. And some people have had the idea that faith is that if you really believe it's going to happen, and we take Matthew 21:22, and all things whatsoever you shall pray, you know, in faith believing you'll receive, and like you can lay that on anything you ever think about and it has to happen. And I just know in my own life, there's some things I'm praying about right now that relate to this ministry, and I don't know exactly what God has in mind. But then, you know, I look at Jesus when He went into the garden. He said, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from Me. He didn't go into the garden demanding, God, You must do this. I know it's possible with You. You remove this cup from Me. I'm going to name it, claim it. That's it. You do it. Jesus didn't pray that way. Now, there are times God may let you know what He's going to do and may give you the faith to ask very, very specifically. But many of you out here, you're praying about things like you're praying about what you ought to major in and you just don't know. And God's not giving you a word. And you think, well, how can I pray? Well, you keep on praying. God, I don't know what to do. If You'll show me, I'll do it. Now, is that praying in faith? Yes, that's praying in faith. I believe it is, because you realize, I don't know what to do. All through the Scriptures you see this. And so be careful not mixing American culture with your Christianity, because you see the sad thing that happened in America, we begin to notice that the baby boomers in the church are not all that different and the people that are living out in the world. The baby boomers out in society, they went for materialism. Well, what did we want as Christians? We also wanted all they wanted. Plus, we expected God to get in on it. God had to do whatever I wanted Him to do. Now, when you see verses like Matthew 21, 22, all things whatsoever you ask in prayer, believing, you shall receive, you don't totally separate that from things like if you ask according to His will, if you ask in His Spirit. You understand what I'm saying? Here's a couple, for example. And this literally happened. A baby boomer couple. They had this little daughter. They loved her very much. She's 6 years old. She's in a car wreck. They're in a church. The mother, as a result of this car wreck, the baby's in a coma, or this little six-year-old girl's in a coma. People marveled at this woman's faith. She said, God's going to take care of it. And she would use the verses like, whatever you ask in prayer, you know, believing God's going to do it. And I just know God's going to do it. God's going to heal her. And so she held on, and people marveled at her faith for 6 months. The baby never came out of the coma. The baby died. You know the conclusion they came to? God let us down. They left the church and are bitter. I talked with a chaplain at the Baptist Hospital in Oklahoma City a number of years ago. He said, Max, we're seeing something we have never, in all of my life being a chaplain, I have never seen before. We see people in these hospitals dying bitter at God. I said, explain that to me. He said, well, they have bought the theology that's rampant in America. Name it, claim it. You know, okay, you've got cancer. Well, it's God's will, and take Isaiah 53. By His stripes you're healed. Now you study that verse. That is not talking about physical healing. He's talking about our salvation. But they'll take verses like that. By His stripes you're healed. And so they'll claim that verse. God doesn't ever want anybody to be sick. I mean, God's a good God. It's not His will for anybody to ever be sick. And then I read this verse one day, and it says, and over in Ezekiel, and when He became sick with the sickness with which He was to die. Now, I don't know what you've seen, but most of the people I ever saw that died got sick first. I mean, some were killed in a car wreck. Now, I know God took Enoch to heaven, but I hadn't seen that lately in Norman. I'm not saying God wouldn't do that or God couldn't do that. I'm not limiting God. I'm saying, folks, that we need to be careful about our theology. And so here's this person, and they have cancer, and they claim God's going to heal them. And God doesn't heal them. And so the man's wife dies. So what does he say? God's not faithful. God won't do what He said. And they turn their back on God. I walked into a man's home in Colorado some time ago. We were up there, up on the mountain where we like to spend some time, and one day I went with a pastor to see this man. And I said to him, this particular guy had cancer. So we walked in, and I said, Lee, how are you doing? He said, well, he'd just gotten out of bed and he looked horrible. He said, I don't look healed, I don't feel healed, but by His stripes I am healed. I mean, what can you say? We visited a few minutes. We got out in the car and I said, Harlan, is anybody close to his wife? Any of you believers up here on the mountain? Anybody that's close to her? He said, well, we know her pretty well. And I said, well, you better get close to her. Because you know what I think is going to happen to Lee? And I don't think this is lack of faith at all. You know what I think is going to happen to him? I think he is going to die. I know God is a great God, and I know God can heal him. But in case God doesn't, somebody better be close to her because she's going to go through it. Because she is living with this theology that if God doesn't do it, then God's not faithful. I called back a few weeks later, talking to her, and I said, by the way, how's Lee doing? He said, oh, we buried him last week. Now be careful about taking the great expectations that were drilled into your parents from the day they were born. And since they had it, it's drilled into you. And some of us know very little difference between what the Word of God teaches and what is American culture. Hebrews 11, I just want to share something with you quickly. You know Hebrews is Hebrews 11, the great chapter of the heroes of the faith. And boy, it starts out Hebrews 11:1. Now faith is assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And I mean here the tremendous stories of Abraham and Noah and people that you've never heard of. I mean, maybe you've heard of them, but all these stories. And he even come and said, well, time wouldn't allow me to tell about Samson and Jephthah and all these people, the tremendous things they did. And here's some of the things that he says, by faith they conquered kingdoms. They performed acts of righteousness. They obtained promises. They shut the mouths of lions. They quenched the power of fire. They escaped the edge of swords. From weakness they were made strong. They became mighty in war. They put foreign enemies to flight. Women received their dead raised back to life. See, God can do those things, and He may choose to. But then all of a sudden, verse 35, it changes. It says, others were tortured. And wait a minute. This is a chapter of faith. These are the people who believe God. Yeah, that's right. You got it right. You're in the right chapter. But others were tortured, not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings. Yeah, mockings. That might even happen to you on the campus. Somebody might laugh at your Christianity or something. I mean, they really received mockings. They received scourgings. You know what a scourging is? That is a severe whipping, beating. They also were in chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. I mean, take a saw and saw them in two. They were tempted. They were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskin. Now listen, they went about in sheepskin. Some of them didn't get killed. Some of them were poor. Christians, believers, but they were poor. Do you know that some of you, if you follow the calling of God for your life, you may not realize all the American dream that you think you want? Did you know that? I mean, God may want some of you in social work. God may want some of you to be an elementary teacher. God may want some of you to be a missionary. God may want some of you working in little churches to help people. God may want you doing some things, and you won't have all the blessings that you think you want. But I want to close by just saying this. I want to recommend some books to you. You say, I don't have time to read. And I say, yes, you do. Do you have time to eat? Well, then you need to also feed your soul. Do you ever, ever, ever attend a concert? Do you ever go to a movie? Do you ever play basketball? Do you ever goof off? Then you have time to read, and you all your life, develop this while you're in college. Always be reading some things you want to read that are not assigned. Something your professor didn't assign. You just want to read it because you want to read it. I want to recommend a book to you. Read it last week. The Cleavers don't live here anymore. You will learn more about the history and about your parents by reading this book probably than you figured out as a result of living with them all your life. You can get it down in the bookstore. If they don't have it, they can order it for you. The Cleavers don't live here anymore. Paula Reinhart and her husband, the lady that wrote this, lived in Stillwater. They worked with the navigators over at OSU for a number of years. One of the dreams she said she had always had in her life, she wanted to have this colonial home with the winding staircase. She said, when I pictured that, I could just smell the cinnamon bread. And she had this picture of what a home would be like. And one day, of course, they never lived in a house like that. And one day, they get the mail, and her husband is looking at an advertisement from American Express credit card. And he's there looking at the mail. She happens to look over his shoulder, and he's looking at this ad. And here's all the things this card promises. You know, the boats, the cars, the trips, and all the good life. That this card, if you just had that piece of plastic, you'd have it. And you'd have it all. So she said to her husband, honey, if you could have everything that card symbolizes, money was no problem, right now, if money was no problem, what would you do? He thought for a little while and he said, I'd take the kids camping. And she said, what? He said, I'd take the kids camping. She said, well, if you had everything you wanted, what else would you want? He said, oh, I'd probably want some good friends. She said, well, now you've taken the kids camping. You got some good friends. What else would you want? He said, oh, I'd want to do something significant with my life. And she said, all of a sudden, sitting there at the table, God broke through to them. All of these years raised as a baby boomers, wanting the great expectations. And she said, all of a sudden we realized. And I began to think about that house that I wanted. And she said, you know, I couldn't buy a turn of the century house. And she said, well, now it's 1993. If we can live a few more years, we will live in a turn of the century house. But it'll be a different century. But she said, I always pictured this, all of this house. And she said, then I began to think, what did that house symbolize? She said, you know what that house symbolized for me? Said, that house symbolized love. Said, I could just see myself sitting at the table there with my husband, us drinking a cup of coffee and talking together. I could see the kids playing around. I could see making them cinnamon rolls. And she said, you know, all of a sudden I realized the house we live in didn't have anything to do with what I really wanted. I want to leave you with a verse of Scripture, 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10. But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can take nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be there with content. But they that will be rich, those that set their heart on riches is what he's talking about, those that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men, and they pierce themselves through with many sorrows. Just like taking a knife and start piercing yourself. Those that will be rich fall into many temptations and a snare. They pierce themselves through with many sorrows. Give your life to the Lord. God may bless you tremendously. You work, you try to make a living, but see, so many people that started making a living for their family then began to work harder to move on up the ladder. And it wasn't just because they didn't have the money to buy the basics of life. And the first thing you know, he's coming in later and the marriage begins to deteriorate. And the first thing you know, there's a divorce. Decide what you really want out of life. You don't have to have it all. God, as a result of the very fact that you're born in America, you've already got more than you'll ever deserve. And so let's give our lives to Him. Decide we're going to walk with Him. We're going to keep our eyes on that which is most important. It's not what house you live in. It's what happens in that house that makes the difference. Now let's pray together. Father, I pray that in no way would this message be used to discourage the students from wanting to do their best and to go on to medical school or whatever else they'd planned and work and be willing to work hard. But, oh Father, I pray that it would be for Your honor and glory, that they would want to honor You with their lives, with their abilities, that even if they make a lot of money, they would find many, many ways to share it, to help other people. And Father, we none of us know what's coming. But I would pray that if sometimes we don't get an answer to a prayer that we had so wanted, that we would never become bitter. When I think of our Lord Jesus living here for 33 years, the wonderful life that He lived. He enjoyed life. I know He loved being with the disciples.